So those hopefully lucky folks who are sitting in the front row, Jan and John Buderak, are this year's auction sermon winners. Which meant that they had what I hope was the distinction of sitting down with me over sandwiches to cook up a sermon topic. And every year I brace myself for this one. It is, considering what the auction yields, my annual "It Better Be Good, Nancy" sermon. And I have to fight every year the desire bubbling within me to apologize in advance. But for this year, we offer for you much to think about. Because when I sat down with Jan and John to talk about this sermon and their ideas for it and all that was bubbling up within them, we did not exactly have a light-hearted conversation, did we? No, we did not. We had, true to form for these two, an honest conversation. An honest conversation that covered important ground and left us all scratching our heads rather than certain of our answers. We talked about human suffering and the calamities that face this planet as it teeters ever closer to the edge of environmental disaster. We talked about the fact that human beings are animals perhaps uniquely capable of cruelty. And finally, we found ourselves positively stumped with a question none of us had the answer to, and that's how I knew where the sermon was. A while ago, last fall, I preached a sermon where I mentioned William James' idea that evil is a sort of mental incapacitation, an inability or gripping unwillingness of a human being to see and to speak the truth. And our conversation sort of stalled out when John asked simply, "Are there any people who are evil and are not crazy?" It's an honest question and an important one. Is it just folks who are sick who intentionally hurt others? And can this desire to hide in the diagnosable darkness be cured by so much well-administered light? First, it must be said that mental illness and moral incapacitation cannot in any way be equated. These are two very different and occasionally overlapping aspects of the human experience. But the idea of evil as a sort of moral disease is worth considering. As is the question of how deep down into the bones of a human being that moral disease is capable of penetrating. After much contemplation, I think I've come down to an answer on John's question, which is yes, absolutely yes. There are those who act as agents of destruction in this world who are not clinically or technically ill. Yes. If you will concede for the sake of conceding something that evil is the desire to knowingly inflict pain upon others, then it is not so much a disease as a tragically inherent parasite that gloms on to the human condition and won't let go unless we forcibly shake it off. And yet, have you ever met a truly evil man? Or a truly evil woman? Have you ever met someone whom you can say in a reasonably unqualified manner, down deep in their bones, is unabashedly evil to the core? In preparing this service, I racked my brain on that question, which is itself a statement of my great privilege and astounding luck. Because I have never been abused or assaulted or even really neglected or profoundly maligned, even my sorely remembered high school arch nemesis who shall remain unnamed, she was just prettier than me and better at sports. If she was guilty of anything, it was being awesome. And the precious truth of my life is that seldom, if really ever, has another human being set out with the intention to do me harm. How lucky am I? The closest blessedly I've ever gotten to a person whose presence denoted something truly evil was a vague discomfort, a creeping dis-ease, a sense of something either not present or not reachable that made me want to walk away. A sense that in some people all
the good stuff is just so covered up with pain and confusion that you can't see it anymore. And to me, that has always felt like the greater tragedy than the parasite of evil itself. Have you ever encountered one utterly overcome by evil? I have not. And perhaps not all of us are lucky enough to need time to think about that question. Have you ever known one so wholly overcome as to be utterly separated from the truth of their own blessedness? I know that among us are those who have fought in wars, who have raised arms in the face of dictators, who have lifted their eyes from the ground to meet the face of those who would hurt you, and have stood up and begun again in the very shadow of those who have cut us down, both literally and metaphorically. Among us are those who have cowered in the shadows of gas pumps in fear of an unseen sniper, and those who have lost the ones we love because someone made the terrible choice to take them away from us. Among us are those who have seen the worst of it, and I know that, so I do not approach this subject lightly. It is distinctly possible, indeed probable, that all of us will encounter evil in our lives. We will, if we have not yet, feel its presence deep down in our bones and know for a fact that something is amiss. We will meet that which seeks to destroy and cares nothing for truth and hides in the treacherous places where light does not shine. And this is not meant to be a warning, just a statement of the facts. And the good universalist in me believes that maybe the evil in this world, the force which means us harm, can never, no matter what, fully claim a human soul. If we are really universalists, after all, the easy part is not believing in hell. Especially for rationalists like us who are more concerned with what is than what will be, but it gets harder, universalism, if you really think about it. Not only are we not going to hell, but even on this plane and in this place, the universalist message causes us to yearn to believe that none of us is wholly lost. Not even Osama bin Laden, not even the ones who wielded the weapons that killed the ones you love, not even the distant memory of one with an absent moral compass and hard eyes that you ran away from a long time ago. You see what I mean? How it's easy to not believe in hell? And another thing entirely, to believe that not even an earthly hell of our own devising is permanent, irrevocable, and unchanging. That not even the crimes we visit upon one another are death sentences for the soul. But this is precisely what I believe on a good day. And that does not mean that redemption, truth presenting itself at long last to the long-shadowed soul, that doesn't mean that redemption is likely. It is perhaps incredibly unlikely much of the time. But that does not mean it's impossible. And while we live, while we move and have our being in this interconnected cosmos, that alone means that we have a shot of some kind of blessed salvation, every one of us. There is evil. Such evil that we might cower in the face of it, and sometimes it wins the most important fights, and its power is greater than that of the good, but it does not dig all the way down to the bones and blood and soul of a human being. It does not get all of us. Or at least while we live, there's the possibility that it doesn't have to. Perhaps not the probability, but the possibility of redemption always remains. Every day, always. And that is harder than not believing in hell, and more important. But if evil doesn't reach all the way down to the bones of a person, if it doesn't claim them entirely, this is not to deny its power. It's not that it isn't real. To paraphrase Hannah Arendt, it's just that it isn't radical. It isn't rare, or unusually dramatic, or even remotely crazy. When you really think about it, evil and evildoers are often shockingly sane. Rather than a dramatic jump on the radar screen of life, It is the presence of evil is more like a steady beat, a part of the landscape. It is ever present, always there, ready to take advantage of all that we lack and grow stronger in the face of what we fear. It is thus not peculiar at all, but utterly commonplace, maybe even boring. A story that's been told 1,000,000 times and will be told 10,000 more, and I don't know which is worse. Radical evil that consumes a few, or commonplace evil that touches us all. Which brings me to our reading. Hannah Arendt's marvelous and terrible image of a fungus growing over top this precious world and laying waste to that which it touches. To her friend, she wrote, "It can overgrow and lay waste the entire world precisely because it spreads like a fungus on the surface. It is thought-defying because thought tries to reach down to depth, to go to the roots, and the moment it concerns itself with evil, there is nothing there. Only the good has depth and can be radical." Now, Arendt was a complicated figure in and of herself. She was a German-Jewish woman who found a way to flee Nazi Germany, but then took up a job at the New Yorker and reported very harshly on the Israeli trials of Nazi war criminals, including Adolf Eichmann. It was in this trial-related reporting that she first used the phrase "the banality of evil" and raised up the question of what separates thoughtlessness from evil itself. Her whole reflection hinged on the question of what the difference is between people who don't think about the consequences of their actions and people who really choose to inflict pain. There are some of the latter, perhaps, but there are many more of the former. It is, as she said, the accumulated force of their simpering silence that really makes destruction possible. What she saw was a world in which the not-thinking, boring sort of evil held more power than the other radical, dramatic kind ever could. And though she finally supported the execution of Eichmann and other Nazi criminals, the crime she found them guilty of was not inherent evil, but a tragic inability to think for themselves. At the end of her book about Eichmann, she said that he must die not to protect others, but because nobody on this planet wanted to spend another day sharing it with the likes of him. Mass opinion, mass laziness, an inability or unwillingness to see that something is amiss, deep down, and to act on that dis-ease for one's own safety and the safety of others and perhaps the salvation of all things. That's how she viewed evil. And it is not radical or all-consuming or crazy or even very deep. It's just this fungus that spreads and spreads as long as we give it space to grow. Which is to say that none of us is wholly lost. But then again, none of us is wholly found either. None of us is completely untouched by that creeping fungus that finds its power in our silence. What do we do with that? In the dark night of the soul that comes with every sermon writing session, I sat in front of my computer screen late last night and wondered if I had created some perverse form of UU original sin. Not my plan. Because I think that the fungus that evil is hides the truth of our blessedness and finds fertile ground in shame and guilt. Shame and guilt, those things are loamy soil in which to nurture the seeds of devastation. But conscience, I suspect, is another thing entirely. If evil is truly banal and not unusual, and some bits of that old fungus are clinging to this very pulpit robe and the Birkenstocks you waltzed in the door wearing this morning, if all of that is real, then how do we know when we've tipped over the edge ourselves, when we have moved from just normal inattention to the kind of inattention that lays waste to whole worlds? As Jan and John asked, when does throwing away the plastic bottle instead of recycling it turn into evil? I think that for most of us, it is not one choice or one moment. None of us can wholly resist being complicit in some destructive things. There are Zen masters who dare not step where an ant might be underfoot, but the rest of us are living in the real world. Our challenge, then, is not to do no harm, because doing no harm is a virtual impossibility, and trying to live up to that expectation would just plant seeds of useless guilt, which paradoxically often sprout as further harm to a world in need. Our challenge is to be at least aware enough of the consequences of our actions that we will not let them pile up on one another until the blessedness we know to be true is obscured. Our challenge is to feel something between astounding guilt and absolutely nothing. And the tool we have to help us toe the line, the tool we have to help us know when we can fudge it a little and when fudging it is just another awful lie, is the great gift of conscience. A. Powell Davies once wrote that he came to church for one reason, because, he said, I must have my conscience sharpened. Sharpened till it goads me to the most thorough and responsible thinking of which I am capable. I must feel again the love I owe to others, not just hear about it, but feel it. And I said before that we can sometimes feel the presence of evil deep down in our bones in the form of an uneasiness. And I think that as long as the fungus has not spread too far, as long as the wires and synapses and soulful yearnings that comprise the human condition are more or less intact, we can also feel conscience deep down in our bones. An innate sense of what should be, a nagging sense of wrong when it is not. The best thing we can do to combat evil is to feel it when it sneaks up and underneath our own simple choices, and respond accordingly without succumbing to the stultifying pressure of guilt. The best thing we can do is to live in the sweet spot between obliviousness and agony, to be permeable and yet cohesive, to feel it all and then let it all go. Working with Arendt's metaphor of the fungus, my colleague Anya Samler-Michael wrote, "Evil is organic. It follows channels of least resistance." If this is so, then it is our job as moral persons to put up resistance, to notice, to pay attention, to be not idlers lying still as the organic forces of untruth creep up and over this corner of the earth that is ours, but to be rabble-rousers, the rabble-rousers we have always yearned to be, and start with the things we know to start with our own little choices, our own missed opportunities, our own failures of conviction. I have plenty of those things. Little choices, missed opportunities, failures of convictions, I've got a whole passel of them, but I also have plenty of chances to begin again. Because the creeping darkness, it's not down deep. It's just on the surface. And it does not own me, or you, or anyone. And even if many of us spend our whole lifetimes telling ourselves the truth, the half-truth, and something other than the truth, the story of our great resistance is never finished being written. We are in this together, and we need not stand by and observe desolation. We only have to name it for what it is, and be goaded, beautifully goaded, into being everything love calls us to be. For the darkness, it's just a veneer. And ever and always, only the good has depth.